It doesn't matter who you are, it's going to happen to you eventually. It's time for us to begin our Bible study this morning, and so you can turn right now to the text of the Gospel of Luke in chapter 9. It doesn't matter, by the way, whatever we do for all of us. We can have announcements, reminders here. You can do all the stuff. You can remember to do all the switches. But there's always going to be one day in which all of that stuff fails for you. And without fail, it'll be at the most uncomfortable and embarrassing moment possible. Such is life. We're continuing our study of the text of the Gospel of Luke. It's a great two-part look at the work of first Jesus as the full plan of God, and then when we look at the book of Acts in the future, it will be the labors of the Christians and the disciples of Christ who shared that gospel message with mankind. But right now we're in chapter 9, and so as we continue, let's start our study with prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for today. We thank you for the blessing that it is to have a space to assemble, a place to assemble, an opportunity to open your word and to prayerfully and with wisdom and discernment consider the message that you have left for us. Help us as students and as followers of Jesus to learn from him and learn from you. Please forgive us of our sins, and this is our prayer in your Son's name. Amen. All right, so as mentioned a couple times already, we are in the Gospel of Luke in chapter 9. Depending on how the schedule plays out, we are going to try to cover maybe a big chunk of this chapter. We've already dealt some with Luke 9 already from last Sunday, but we've got a few things that we still want to make sure we pay attention to. So as we kind of lay into the text, just some things to remind yourself about. Remember, we're looking at the portion of the work of God, that is, whatever it is God did through Jesus in the time frame of his life physically upon the earth that is relevant to the broader needs of the kingdom. Something that's always important for me, at least, is to recognize that within all four of the gospel accounts, we don't get everything. We don't even get every detail of the events that are selected. We get the portions of it that cross a couple of criteria. Criteria number one, by inspiration, we get the information that is selected to the four audiences of these books. Criteria number two, we're going to have to deal with a couple layers of filtering that come through our human disposition. Number one layer of filtering is we live 2,000 years-ish removed from these events. So we filter the entire Bible through the lens of our personal humanity right now. That requires us to make distinctions between culture and the commentary of God. And those are not always the same thing, but sometimes they actually are. Sometimes the culture we read about is a biblical culture in the midst of a world culture, and so we have to do that level of filtering. Second filter is a language filter. We filter it through the translations we suggest and select. We filter it through our own communication limitations, whether we bring them to the table or they are imposed upon us. And a third filter is the maturity of our faith. I think you probably can recognize this in your own spiritual growth, that the first time you read a passage is a little bit different and the next time, and the next time. The words themselves don't change, but how they impact and affect our decision process and the way we see the world around us changes on a regular basis. And you'll find yourself, especially if you're a regular note taker, you keep your notes kind of collated to the text itself, you'll be like, hey, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 2 weeks ago, I made this note. Why did I do that? Why did I say that? Why did I think that was super important? Do I agree with it anymore? Did I agree with it when I wrote it down? Because sometimes you keep notes about things because you disagree with them. But you don't always label everything properly. And so you're going back through stuff and you're like, why did I do that? And you read through it again, and you study it again. Oh, okay, that's why I did that. That's part of the filtration process of any biblical text. Any learning moment is like that. And so when we're looking at this message, keep that in mind and use as your bedrock the reminder of that God gave this to us for a reason. It's inspired or presented or breathed through the vessels of God's service to us. We should then be careful and cautious with our interaction with it in ways that are going to kind of either flow over our filtration surfaces as necessary or change the way we filter information on our personal side so that we are getting closer to that goal of being more like Jesus and more like Christ and less like ourselves. Less, well, I want this, I need this, I see this. It should be in more of God wants this for me and God shares this with me. And this is the message of God from the Son of God. So in chapter 9, verses 1 through 11, one of the interesting aspects of all of this, which is a miraculous iteration, one of the two in the Gospels of God providing otherworldly control over things that are either super otherworldly, demons, or in this particular case I'm referencing to ordinary things, providing food. That's a fairly ordinary behavior. Here's the way to think about it. How many meals have you made for other people in your life? Everyone's like, I really don't even actually know that number. It could either be really, really large and so large that you can't even fathom. That's why sometimes folks, as they mature in life, they don't realize that one of the most important tasks they'll be doing forever and ever and ever is deciding what their family eats every week and every day, like forever without end, like, and it's just kind of overbearing. But we don't remember that. How many bad meals have you made for people? Like this should never have existed in your notebook to begin with. And like, I'm not just talking like you didn't cook it just right. Like everything went absolutely horrible. Is that a smaller list? For most of us, I don't necessarily fall in that category. But for most of us, it's a much smaller list, right? With that understanding of thinking through that, that makes meals, average meals, incredibly ordinary. We eat. You ask us what we had a week later. I had dinner. We don't remember the details of it. It was nourishing. It was healthy. It was good. What stands out are the things that are odd. So here's the connector piece to get to this biblical principle. There is somebody on this planet, and maybe more than one somebody, who remembers you solely for one reason. You did something weird in front of them. You behaved in an odd or a strange way, and they remember because of your weird behavior. It is so strange and so out of the normal that why would they do that? And they're not upset about it. It's just odd. And you're remembered for that one thing. They might not even know who you are. They may actually know you, but they might not, because it was so extraordinary. So think about meals, because the Bible's talking about food here and using it as teaching truths. It ties to Old Testament stories. It ties to the story of Jesus. It ties to our story. Ordinary and extraordinary things. God's control over the ordinary and the extraordinary. And how weird it would be to have something in your cultural history, not one time, but two times. Because the first time something happens weird, it's just weird. That's odd. That's a little bit strange. The history of Israel includes God providing for their food, their sustenance, in a miraculous format as a structure of their identity. When we talk about God providing manna in the wilderness, that biblical story, that historical interaction between God and the people of God as they're growing into their identity, which is another key thing in this text right here, it became a function of whom they were. It formed the structure of some of their, what we would consider artwork, poetry. Biblical poetry is, and biblical singing, that's artwork. That's part of their culture in that regard. But also the foundational nature of the way that they saw themselves in view to other kingdoms and places around on the earth. God provided for us directly. He was concerned with us directly. He interacted with us on a regular basis. Even in the midst of our punishment, he provided. Part of their shared identity is now connected to that. And so you have that side of the picture. Now you're an Israelite, that's your cultural heritage. And there is a prophet, you think, a unique or wise rabbi or instructor, you suspect. And he's got close disciples who are kind of different in their behavior a little bit too, because they come from everywhere in their culture, very zealot-like, very impoverished, wealthy, all of those different criteria, despised or accepted. And that Jesus, that guy named with a kind of a common name in their culture, provides for them like God did. It's equivalent, but actually more broad than the demons. Because now this affects everybody. But it connects a higher level of connection, ties it together a little more securely, in that in the prior instances, were there any intermediaries between God's provision of food and the entire camp of God's people being served? How did that process, if you think back to the Old Testament, and the manna and the water, the dew that was on the ground, what level of intermediate service took place? How did it get from God's provision to the families of God? They had to go out and collect it, right? They had to harvest. They had Sabbath harvest expectations too. And so they had to do something in advance for the Sabbath and plan for that. But they still had to go out and acquire it. And if they kept too much, what happened to it? It was rotten up, you know. So they had to manage you had to get enough. And on a day-to-day basis, they created this relationship with the process. Now, part of the intention would have been that they would have known who it come from and acknowledged that Elohim or God or Jehovah or the Lord, Adonai, was the one who was giving this to them. And you certainly would have seen priests and Levites probably kind of making comments about that at different times. From the teaching standpoint, the Bible even shows some of that taking place. But now think about this. How does it take place in this iteration of this kind of endeavor? When you think about the feeding miracles in the New Testament, where is God? Where are the disciples and where are the people? Is it similar or different? It's got some similarities, but there's some key differences, right? Because God's still doing the providing and he's giving them what they need. What are some of those key differences? Right, there's a big shift in it's being brought to them. How do you feel in restaurant context if you go to a restaurant where they bring you the food versus you go and get the food? What's your mindset about that endeavor in our culture? You're getting served, and one's fancier than the other, right? And there's a cultural expectation in a lot of those places where those servants who bring you the food, the 26 feet from the cashier to your table or from the back house to your table, you tip them, right? You provide them gratuity for their service. That's our cultural expectation. If you're going to be the last mile of the road delivery, which is 26 feet, usually to 30 feet from one place to the other. But the experience is different. I don't have to get up from my table. Do we behave differently when we're in one restaurant or the other? Here's a way to think about it. Two interesting concepts. In the table spaces where we're served, we can be entitled. We shouldn't be, but we can feel entitled. Those places where you're being served, if a family brings their small children to that environment, little tiny children that are really loud, which is basically all children and me, those two categories, do you complain about those noises if you're there with at a quiet table trying to have a quiet meal and the table next to you is super loud? Emotionally, you want to. Realistically, you know, that's not right. There's nothing wrong with that kid being there. But you go through all those intellectually, you know, those steps. Because you have to remember, hey, it's not about me. All that stuff comes in. You mature yourself. And sometimes you're excited because there's livelihood next to you. Like, oh, that's so cute. I remember when. And you have all those different experiences. But we see those as different. Because we know those key differences matter in our culture. Well, in this culture, they do too. In the biblical worldview and the Bible, this is a shift. This is a shift of service. But it also shifts how they see the disciples, the ones who are serving in this way. Because if you see someone walking along with a basket in a culture that is incredibly impoverished, where food is not stored up at this point at all because they don't have that level of abundance, and the basket they're pulling all this from as they're going from segment to segment is this size, let's say it's as big as my arms even. It wasn't, but let's say it's as big as my arms. And they can hold like this. And there's enough in it that it doesn't run out as they actually feed a massive army of people. And then there's crumbs left over afterwards that are massive. Some of the other things that have shifted from our Old Testament narrative are impacted by the things that are also the same. Did God oversupply the Israelites in the wilderness? Well, he did, because they had extra. They couldn't just take all of it. And if they took extra, it would spoil. He overprovided. Did he overprovide for these? Is God not a good logistician that he can't figure out how much these folks need? Like, he doesn't have the ability to determine these Israelites and these Judeans, they only need so much? God blesses abundantly. His constant standard when he blesses the people who seek him is always more than they need. Like, that's really super consistent on the blessing level of God. And so you see that here too. What's different as well, which I think is super significant in the gospel account, is how close God is to the people. God is in their midst. Do they really know that God is there? No. Old Testament God, context. What happened when someone got really close to God in the Old Testament? In some cases, they could literally die. And then we see that happening. We see other cases they get close to God and God creates a space that's safe for them. Hang out on the rock over here. Hide here, be in my close space, but not too close. But something that's important about every single Old Testament encounter between man and God is that man is always changed. 100% true that in every encounter between one of the creation, men, and the divine, man gets changed. His name gets changed. His appearance gets changed. His life gets changed. His direction gets changed. Now you think about those who are around Jesus. Did Jesus create circles of change in his life? Was all upon the earth? Absolutely. And the level of change very often is very simple to catch. How close did they get? How close were they to God himself? And so when you come up with questions like, who is this that would have that kind of change? That's the backdrop. That's the historical backdrop, cultural backdrop, biblical backdrop, and some of the things that the text itself is showing. Before we step into the next two sections of the text, though, since we've already talked about it last week and a little bit today, what are you guys' thoughts on this passage right here? This is mainly looking verses 1 through 17 before we get into verse 18. Any thoughts or things that were super interesting to you that we haven't talked about yet? I want to make sure we don't push everything off the shelf before we move forward. Michael?
You actually mentioned it, and I never thought about it before, about how in the Old Testament and here, they have way more than their need. They're just blessed abundantly. And I wonder, do they know that? Because I know sometimes we are blessed abundantly, and I often wonder if I forget that. I mean, we don't necessarily need electricity. It is a wonderful blessing. And we're blessed like that today, abundantly. I actually ask myself, do I recall that?
I know for myself, this is how I think about it. It may not be the way you do, but we tend to only acknowledge blessings when we don't have them anymore. And the quickest illustration of that is the American invention of air conditioning. If you are in the summer and your air conditioning goes away, the curse of the temperature comes up, right? And you absolutely recall the blessing of air conditioning because you've become accustomed to the status quo. When it takes away, where's the blessing of air conditioning? We call all the people. We want to get it fixed right away. Got to have it right now. And then those service providers are a blessing to us. And then they leave. We paid them. And then we forget about them. I think that's a struggle for all of us. I don't think there's anyone of us who's able to fully escape that struggle and cycle.
I kind of look at it, feel at the closure of the day, at the end of the day, especially when I pray at night, there is an attempt to acknowledge those blessings that you didn't, you can't recall exactly when it happened. But when the day is over, you look back and you say, wow, everything I needed was there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that I didn't acknowledge while it was happening as a blessing. And it will allow me to go a step further. I try to examine my prayer and make sure that what I'm saying truly represents what I have done.
Yeah.
That's the way I kind of summarize all of my daily blessings.
Right, and I think that's something that's a point of maturity for all of us is to recognize that, and then we also include in those blessings often boundaries or speed bumps or individuals who redirect us away from poor decisions. They who might have seemed like a thorn when they struck us become a blessing when they redirected us either back to God or off of our folly, or away from rebellion, or just away from foolishness. And so there's some great perspective moments. Another layer, and something I'm personally trying to get better at, is making sure that I acknowledge the blessings earlier. Like, let's try to stretch and acknowledge, especially the blessings that are hard and uncomfortable and challenging. Those are blessings, even though they don't necessarily feel like it. When we are receiving punishment, because punishment in of itself rarely feels like a blessing, but it finishes like one. Anything else in this section? All right, so something's going to happen in the text here that's super important. I think most biblical readers and people who are concerned with God and with Jesus are super familiar with this interaction that Jesus is kind of connected to regarding Peter, right? This is a super familiar thing. Where it says in the New Testament here in this iteration, Gospel of Luke chapter 9, verse 18, "Now it happened that he was praying alone. The disciples were with him, and he asked them, 'Who do the crowds think I am?' And they answered, 'John the Baptist.' But others say, 'Elijah.' And others, 'One of the prophets of old has arisen.' Then he said to them," the disciples, the close ones, "'But who do you say that I am?' And Peter answered, 'The Christ of God.'" How many of us have read that before? That's pretty much like everybody raise their hand based on the audience here, right? We've all read that or heard that in our mind before. Here's something to think about. From Luke chapter 1, verse 1, to Luke chapter 9, verse 17, this is the climax of what has been laid out for us. This is the summation of the prophetic work of God. It's the summation of the introduction an expectation of the messianic theme of the Bible. And it really is more than just, hey, you know, what kind of man is this? He's a prophet. This is the pinnacle or the climax of God's biggest mystery being revealed. Yes, there's resolution in the cross. And the method was a surprise to some. But the reality of the Son of God being with mankind in an open way was not something that was anticipated by the participants in the history of Israel. The prophets didn't know it. The Bible clarifies that for us, that they didn't have a full picture. They yearned to know who the Anointed One was. They yearned to know who the Messiah was. That's the same phrase in different ways that we express it. They yearned to see the day. If they had an understanding of it, they longed to see the day. But all of them are living under what Paul calls a bit of cloud cover. He uses terminology that says it wasn't revealed to them. It was a mystery to them. But now it was revealed. So if you're looking for a textual point where you highlight in your Bible and says, what are some of the most important events? This right here. Now we pull it apart a lot of times. We pull it apart on the basis of, well, because Peter said this, and he says it in Matthew in a different iteration of it with a few extra bits of information and some dialogue there, or we think about why is the one that Peter steps up and answers this question so boldly and quickly in the text? Well, that's not, no surprise, right? Our presumption of Peter is that he is ready to commit and ready to answer, ready to do. Not always with wisdom, but he's certainly zealous in that regard. But in the big picture of things, this is a big reveal. Because think back, from Luke 1:1 to Luke 9:17, was Jesus himself regularly precise and clear with who he is? Not really. Like, we know the answer to the story because we've read the end of the book. You know, there's no twists if you already know that Jesus is the Christ. But this is a surprise reveal if you think like everyone else did. He's Elijah. He's John the Baptist. Is that surprising that they think Jesus is John the Baptist, by the way? It's a yes-no thing for me. Like, it's kind of surprising because you'd figure, like, these are two different people. But we tend to think we have the ability to research everybody. I can find out where they're from. I can go online and find their history. I can see their photos. There'll be an expose on 60 Minutes about their background. And well, I'll know everything about them. I'll go to the Heavy does great biographies of modern people. They'll have five great facts about Jesus. And they'll just have it out there for me. And so when I go to this event, I know everything already. I'm just seeing it take place. That's not how it functions in the community that this is taking place in. And remember, this is a neat little twist. Are Jesus and John related? Do they have the same family heritages? You ever see family members together, Brown family included, that all kind of look alike? Yeah, I just saw like a bunch of the Brown brothers together. Like, yeah, like, they look a whole lot alike, right? Yeah, Rich is like, I don't see what he's talking about. You know, Rich just had a fifth mirror, you know, that way he'll could see everything. But like, they do look similar. So if you don't know, and they didn't, and your expectations don't have all this level of extra clarity that we do, that makes sense. But also recognize what they wanted. They didn't want John to be dead. John the Baptist, John the Immerser. Nor would they necessarily have known. Or they may have thought he had risen again. Because they're putting him in the same space as another spokesman for God who was super amazing to them. And Jesus is actually now being revealed in advance of those forerunners. As John and Elijah are both forerunners of Jesus in this regard. They laid verbal foundation upon the foundation which is Christ himself, but now it's Christ revealed. So that's in a moment there where Jesus as the Messiah, but Jesus and His glory are being presented to us in the text as well. Because the next thing that happens textually by Luke is one of those Jesus things. He strictly charged and commanded them to tell this to no one, saying, "The Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and on the third day be raised." So kind of think about this for a second, about how that would all piece together and play out. All the prior instances of Jesus telling disciples, "Don't talk about this," how did that play out? Were they really good about following that particular instruction? Yeah, they were generally not committed. What about these close disciples? Do they run around telling everybody that He's the Messiah, as far as we can read in the text? Now, what's interesting to me in part is it seems as if to a degree that they feel like they act like it didn't happen, or forget, or don't understand, because it doesn't get repeated by them in various ways. And when Jesus is given over and is punished and is crucified and does rise again, they all respond in super weird ways across the spectrum of all those possibilities. Hey, Rich, we've got some guests outside. If you could step out and kind of direct them to the back, that'd be great. Within all of those things, you think about what's going on and kind of all the possibilities. Jesus now then serves to guide that group through the same experiences we go through in understanding who Jesus is. Because the gospel here from Luke chapter 9 forward builds on this singular truth, that the Jesus who we're now seeing is more than prophet, more than priest, more than just a special, unique human. He is God personified, God present, and God who seeks, who wants them and desires them. And so we see this Christological thing about Christ, the understanding or logic of this being Jesus, unfold itself slowly in the text. Because it steps to the next level. And this ties it to the last parts of Jesus as well. If you think about verse 23, there it says, "And He said to all, 'If anyone would come after Me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow Me. For whoever would save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for My sake will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? Whoever is ashamed of Me and My words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when He comes in His glory and the glory of the Father and of the holy angels. But I tell you truly, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God." So you see those increments play out. First increment, Jesus being revealed as the glorified Messiah. Peter acknowledges it. This is the Son of God. Second increment, Jesus tells about what that glory looks like. Third increment, that glory that was with Jesus, we're going to share it. It gets shared in a couple of ways there. That's why what makes this one of the most central and integral principles, but also text in the Gospel of Luke, because it's that central to the story. And we don't always kind of break it down that way because we accept it already. We acknowledge that that's what Jesus wants for us. But here's where it happens. This is that big moment. What did you guys see in the text here now that I've kind of explained a bunch of stuff and thrown all these different comments at you? What did you guys read or see or recognize and hear in reading through the Luke account here in chapter 9 that was important to you? Or extra comments you have about all the stuff I just kind of provided? Rich?
So when Jesus feeds the 5,000, Mm-hmm. So to me, it's just kind of interesting how that huge event occurs, and then it's kind of left up to the people, but we don't know what happens after that. So did they talk about it? I know Jesus reminds the disciples, like, do you remember that happening? And you're just looking for a sign, right? So
yeah.
So part of it is, it's very interesting how it's not really glorified in this huge procession and constantly being talked about. But the experience that those people had to have been amazing.
Yeah, it was.
Think about it, just like, wow.
You could equate it to you had to be there type level of experience because it doesn't reoccur in the text. Now, a couple of things I want to point out. That's why one of the things I introduced when we began today was to recognize that what we have is a selection of the history of Jesus. And so it's entirely plausible that those are the two options. Those two separate events, because they're not really the same in their presentation and timing, are it. It's entirely possible that there was more. But the specifics are this is what God chose to give to us. And that's super important, because it leverages forward the next part of the story. Joe?
You've kind of found an interesting in Jesus' appearance, especially when you look at how the disciples. John raises some interesting points as to how the religious leaders, for the most part, they just did not accept Jesus as being the Messiah in their sight, what they expected. Now, was that just a big lie on their part to hold on to power? Or were they truly experiencing what they thought the Messiah would look like? Surely they knew about the 4,000 to 5,000, but to put that in perspective, in my mind, I've always looked at those miracles and I would compare those with the crossing of the Red Sea, the miracles that took place in the Old Testament. Bear in mind, we're kind of still in the Old Testament, but it seemed to me like what the shift that I see. Jesus is taking mankind into a realm where he's expecting them to look at him as being one who, for the most part, is to nourish the soul,
yeah,
the mind, more so than just the physical.
Here's some things to think about, I think are important for us to consider. And I'm going to couch this in generalities. This is a general thing, not a specific one person, another person thing. It seems that humanity, mankind, is incredibly stubborn. We are a stubborn and rebellious people, as a refrain. It seems that generally, mankind is also incredibly petty and self-focused. Men may not be, but mankind tends to be. With those two truths, and similar ones as well, and humanity's base self-facing nature. Think about how people responded to this, these two miracles of feeding, as an example. Jesus makes statements that said, you're literally coming here for the food. You shouldn't be doing that. Like, that's a breakdown of Jesus' condemnation of behavior. You're here for the food, not for the food. Like, you want the food that fills the belly, but not the food that will fill or fix your soul. That's not just a New Testament biblical morality issue or an Old Testament biblical morality issue. That's a people issue. And we do that in spite of super obvious information that says, this is not a great idea. Like, you have every impetus around you that knows that this is a bad decision. And we as mankind still make that bad decision. On an individual level, on a me level, and a we level, we do that. So when we talk about the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the leaders in the Sanhedrin, those who would have power and why they would do it, all the reasons we do. Yes, some of them are probably going to fit into the cling to power and lie about it realm. Some of them are not going to believe. There is no way he fed 4,000 people. There is no way he fed 5,000 people. It's not possible that that person, that child, that adult was blind and can see. It's not possible that he cast out demons. There's no way that demons named Legion went into a herd. That didn't happen. For all the reasons, we would say the same thing about anything. You know, what do you mean so-and-so beat so-and-so yesterday? So-and-so was ranked 1 and so-and-so was ranked 35. That can't happen. I'll believe it when I see it. That's part of our stubborn nature and our individual arrogance, that we know and we're smarter than other persons somewhere else. And so that's an important thing to kind of put. That's what I see part of that text kind of playing itself out. Michael?
When I look at these verses, 25 just always jumps out to me when it says, what does a man profit if he gain the whole world and lose or forfeit his own soul? That's one of those verses that tells me, hey, Michael, you better have your priorities in check. I spent too many years, I've said this before, so I can't hear you. I spent too many years working two jobs. And maybe much of the time, I didn't have priorities in line. And this is one of those verses that just reminds us, it doesn't necessarily have to be the same thing for me, the same thing for you, and the same thing for somebody else. We better make sure we have our priorities here.
Yeah, I recently listened to a podcast by a friend, Chris Emerson, who preaches in Lindale, Texas, and he's got a separate non-preachery podcast he does that just kind of encourages you to make right decisions and to grow yourself. And in this space, it's a very simple question. Do your finances match your stated priorities? Do you spend like you speak? If you talk about the kingdom of heaven, do you spend like the kingdom of heaven matters? If you talk about being charitable and giving and servant-minded, does your pocketbook, if you were to audit yourself, match that? I'll add one more step to it. Do we treat others with that same prioritized mindset? Do we see God with the priority we give him in our speech? So you're the creator of everything. Do we see him that way and actually respond to him as the creator of everything? Those are important ways to challenge yourself to maybe more internalize the message. Richard, do you have something? I thought your hand was up a second ago. All right. Bobby?
Proverbs 14 says that there were 5,000 men, but the Jews didn't count the women and children. So probably more than 5,000.
Right. That generic statement there is like a baseline. There are a couple of criteria that would expand the number to an unknown amount. You would obviously recognize that the crowd is not male only. Children would have likely been there. And so you're just saying this is the baseline. It's not just Jewish history, it's general history in the region at that point. That they didn't mathematically calculate crowd capacity levels like we do, where we want every single human person counted and we'll say the crowd had this many people. That's not how they worked and functioned in that regard. Les?
Yeah, I'm just reminded of what John said in John 21, verse 25, when he was talking about what we have written that we read is just a small sampling of what God did. John says, now there are many other things that Jesus did where every one of them were written. I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written.
Yeah.
So that's telling me that what we see is just a small sampling, and people saw a lot more things.
Yeah, they saw a fraction. You know, we see a fraction of what they saw, but that fraction that we see is connected to whom Jesus' identity should be seen as. And Luke doesn't begin his gospel this way. John does. It starts before our perspective of creation begins. The Word begins before creation in that way it's laid out there. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God. In John 1:14, the Word became flesh and dwelt among men. And then we are revealed that the Word is the anointed, it's Jesus. And so you see all this unfurl. When you know that, it becomes no surprise that Jesus can make food out of a little bit of food. Like, oh, okay, that makes total sense now. But that shouldn't suspend our amazement at the event. We should still be amazed that God did that. It shouldn't suspend the connection that by inspiration God is making between all the otherworldly things he's done, controlling the winds, the seas, the people, the demons, life, death, food, everything, concludes with, "Thou art the Christ," or "the anointed of God." Now, he doesn't necessarily by this point recognize fully that Jesus is God in that statement. He's acknowledging, "You are the anointed of God." So this will continue to blossom into next steps. I got you, Joe, in just a second. It'll blossom bigger as it goes forward. But it's that conclusion that is driving towards the transformation of the disciples and us. Joe, we got last comment here before our Bible class time is up.
It seems to me like in Jesus' attempt, if you'll have it, to reveal himself to humanity at large, is when he stated that I can take down this temple and rebuild it in 3 days. Now, from a physical standpoint, anybody that knows anything about construction, engineering, whatever, knowing how long it took the Israelites to build the temple, in their mind, this is just impossible. That was not like feeding this 3,000 or 5,000. He can't do that.
Yeah.
But in my mind, that was one of his last attempts to let them know that what I'm talking about is not necessarily in the physical realm only.
Yeah. Yeah, he was shifting it. He says, with that statement, it wasn't even about the temple. He was talking about himself, but it was on the backdrop of the temple. And so that picture is to help them understand how you're seeing the world is not how you should see the world. Do not see it with earthly eyes that think that impossible things shouldn't happen, because they are going to happen, because they're not actually impossible. And that includes his work and reconciliation and God's big plan. That's it for our class time this morning. And so we'll have to continue next week picking up in the story of the work of Christ. Thank you, everyone, for your participation. And we'll see you next week for this.